Welcome to the CRE Exchange Podcast, where we deep dive into the global trends and challenges of CRE professionals across all sectors of the commercial real estate industry. We engage with experts in the space to bring you innovative insights into industry practices, opportunities, and challenges to better inform your decisions. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a global leader in asset and fund intelligence for commercial real estate.
Welcome to another episode of CRE Exchange. I'm Cole Perry, your host and Associate Director of Research here at Altus Group, a leading provider of asset and fund intelligence. Today, I'll be sharing the latest news and trends shaping the U.S. commercial real estate market. It is a busy time for the research team, so I am flying solo on this episode. But don't worry, Omar will be back with us next time. For today's topic, we're diving into a recurring favorite. This is earnings season. So kicked off a few weeks ago with banks, and now we're shifting focus to public REITs. So as of this recording, we have completed the first week of REIT earnings. And I'd like to walk you through some key highlights from the result calls across major property sectors. So this recap covers calls through October 25th. Some sectors, namely multifamily and hospitality, have not reported yet. However, I'll do my best to provide some insights on those sectors where possible. Perhaps we'll be able to cover those sectors on a future episode as well. So let's kick it off with one of the sectors that's seen a lot of success in recent years. First, I covered industrials. So we're taking a look at Prologis and Rexford here. So Prologis is the world's largest industrial real estate company specializing in logistics facilities, warehouses, distribution centers, and they're sort of known as the backbone of e-commerce. They are the largest landlord for many tenants like Amazon, FedEx, and other 3PL companies. And they are also among the earliest REITs to report earnings. So they hosted their call on October 16th. And for quarter three, they actually beat analyst expectations on earnings, but missed on revenue. So they ended the quarter with 96.2% occupancy, an estimated 300 basis points above the market, according to their executives. And they raised $4.6 billion in new debt with a maturity of 9 years during the third quarter. So they also deployed nearly $1.5 billion to acquire 14 million square feet at what they estimate to be 20% below replacement cost. They had significant net effective rent change across their portfolio, 68% due to mark-to-market lease trends. And they garnered an additional $90 million in NOI by rolling leases up to market rents. On a negative note, they forecast a 3% decrease in market rents, a significant portion of which is going to be due to the Southern California market. Company management expects global rents to bottom out and vacancy to peak in mid-2025. But they also expect an improved market for transactions in the short term. They've increased their guidance for acquisitions to $1.75 to $2.25 billion. However, they did reduce their guidance for development. Rexford is also an industrial REIT. They are focused on owning and operating these sort of high demand infill logistics properties across Southern California. So their strategy centers around value add repositioning, redevelopment, and strategic acquisition of infill properties. They reported their earnings one day after Prologis did on October 17th. They beat analyst expectations on earnings, but missed on revenue. So they reported a year-on-year increase in funds from operation of 5.4%, bringing that up to 9.3% through the first 9 months of 2024. Their occupancy hit 97.6%, and same property NOI guidance was revised upward to 4.25 to 4.75%. Rexford deployed about $60 million for new investments during the third quarter. They have another $200 million under contract, but they also completed $44 million in sales as part of their kind of ongoing portfolio optimization. So they have stabilized 7 redevelopment projects year to date. These have an 8.4% yield on $165 million in investment. And they are actively managing some tenant transitions. They ran into a bit of a bump with LL Flooring's bankruptcy. That's formerly Lumber Liquidators. So they had a move out and they're supporting redevelopment efforts at some of those properties. But looking ahead, they expect 34% NOI growth over the next 3 years through repositioning, even with some of those flat market rents. They're seeing smaller spaces under 50,000 square feet holding stronger than larger ones. They have $200 million in acquisition opportunities in the pipeline, as I mentioned, $75 million of redevelopment activities for the remainder of this year, and nearly $200 million for the next. So they are really focused on some conservative growth, despite a lot of macroeconomic uncertainty. Management also mentioned on the call that they're watching the presidential election quite closely. But turning our attention to the office sector, I covered two quite different companies here. One is SL Green. SL Green happens to be the largest office landlord in New York City. They are known for their high-profile Class A office holdings. You might know them for One Vanderbilt and some major redevelopment projects like One Madison Avenue. But they also have a debt business, so they operate in both the debt and equity spaces. They announced their results on October 17th. They beat analyst expectations on earnings, and they beat on revenue. They had a fairly positive call. SL Green has experienced four consecutive quarters of positive leasing momentum. They actually resumed their debt and preferred equity business after taking a four-year break, and they're really targeting some mezzanine loans in the space. They are also taking advantage of strong demand for Class A space in New York in East Midtown, which has been the subject of a lot of negative stories recently. But they are hoping to achieve 92.5% occupancy across their portfolio by year end. On the individual project side, One Madison is now fully built. Their anchor tenant is IBM. They also have attracted Franklin Templeton. And on the subject of One Vanderbilt, the summit at One Vanderbilt, which is their observatory overlooking New York, has seen up to 6 million guests in just 3 years. The company has announced a partnership this past quarter with Giorgio Armani on a new boutique and a residential project, which solidified their focus on high-profile luxury developments. They're also celebrating a major lease renewal, or did during the third quarter, an expansion with Bloomberg. Bloomberg has secured 925,000 square feet at 919 Third Avenue in New York, far exceeding management at SL Green's expectations. Looking ahead, though, they expect rents to rise across Manhattan as demand strengthens. They are also planning to scale back lease concessions. They have started with reductions in free rent offerings, and it looks like, at least from their announcement of a closure of their recent debt fund and some stock buybacks, that they're doing quite well during broader market uncertainty. So a bit of a green shoot for the office sector. Highwoods is another office REIT. So they're focused on owning, developing, and managing office buildings in the Sun Belt's best business districts, or BBDs, as they call them, with a portfolio concentrated in cities like Nashville, Raleigh, Tampa. They emphasize high-quality, highly amenitized assets through a strategy that they actually call Highwoodizing. So they announced results on October 23rd. They missed on analyst expectations for earnings and on revenue. So during the third quarter, they reported a net income of $14.6 million. That's about 14 cents per share, along with funds from operation at $97 million or 90 cents per share. They've remained fairly active on the investment front. They completed $84 million in non-core asset sales, despite some of the obvious headwinds from higher interest rates. They have about $500 million in their development pipeline. That's been a key driver of growth for them. Nearly half of the pipeline is pre-leased, and they're seeing additional demand, about 140,000 square feet. So 61,000 square feet of first-generation leases were signed in the third quarter. They had a retail built-to-suit project that was successful. Their second-gen leasing activity hit about 530,000 square feet, and that's the highest in over a decade. So in Tampa, they signed 97,000 square feet. It's 26,000 square feet leased in Midtown East. Meanwhile, they've finalized some plans for the repositioning of a major asset in Nashville, Symphony Place, and they have no tenant move-outs in that property expected during 2025. despite some of the kind of individual leasing successes listed on the call, they do face some challenges. They found it harder to offload some of their properties that they've deemed to be distressed. This is kind of limiting their opportunity for additional acquisition. They do have $150 million in assets that they would like to sell, including a property in Pittsburgh. They've expressed a little bit of caution in some of those markets. But higher financing costs are squeezing out new build-to-suit developers in the office space. And so Highwood says that they have a lot of pricing power for their kind of highly amenitized office and mixed-use properties. Now we will turn our attention to the retail sector. One of the companies I took a look at here was Retail Opportunity Investments Corp. So they're specialized in grocery-anchored shopping centers. They're located in kind of supply-constrained affluent markets along the West Coast. They are focused on what they like to call necessity-based retail. And they really target properties with high demand from tenants, which I think should go without saying. But they announced their earnings on October 23rd. They missed big on earnings per share, but they beat on revenue. In the third quarter, ROIC reported funds from operation of around $33 million, 25 cents per share. They leased 1.2 million square feet year to date, including 450,000 square feet in the third quarter alone. Same center, NOI rose 1.5 over the first 9 months. They also reduced 2025 anchor lease maturities from 22 to 10 leases, expecting to renew all remaining leases of those anchors and adding about $2 million in additional revenue. So they also acquired a $70 million center in San Diego. On the external front, they remain concerned about rising interest rates. Higher financing costs have definitely slowed down transaction activity. This has really put a damper on their acquisition efforts. But same center NOI is expected to end 2024 in the 1-2% range. They have some anchor leases that are lacking renewal options. And so there is potential volatility in their year-end financials, as noted on their call. Despite challenges, they do have a 97.1% occupancy rate. They've seen 12 consecutive years of rent growth, very strong fundamentals, and they expect 2025 performance to align with some of their historical averages for re-leasing efforts. We've also got Phillips Edison. Phillips Edison is another REIT that is specialized in grocery-anchored neighborhood shopping centers. They announced earnings on October 25th. They missed big on earnings as well, but beat on revenue. In quarter three, same center NOI increased 3.2%. Core FFO reached $84.4 million. The company did revise its net income guidance to 50 cents per share and expects NAREIT FFO between $2.35 and $2.39 per share for the year. Phillips Edison is investing $40 to $50 million annually in development and repositioning projects. They're targeting 9 to 12% yields. They updated their acquisitions guidance to $275 to $325 million for the remainder of 2024. They did acquire six new properties in the third quarter. These have anchors like King Soopers and Big Y. Their portfolio achieved an occupancy rate of 97.8%. and anchor occupancy of 99.4%. So they have very strong tenant demand. They've seen re-leasing spreads of nearly 20%. They did discuss a bit of external challenges on the call. They're saying that credit card delinquencies are troubling, posing risks to consumer spending. There's a lot of bad debt that's risen about 86 basis points year to date. Formal sit-down restaurants are showing a bit more volatility than they would like to see, as opposed to quick-service restaurants. They mentioned Jersey Mike's and Dunkin' Donuts, which actually performed quite well in their portfolio. They reported $1.2 million as a write-off from a debt extinguishment, and some uncollectible reserves are impacting their guidance. But despite these, executives on their call remain pretty optimistic about mid to high single-digit core FFO growth in the long term. They are trying to balance their acquisition strategy with kind of this continued operational strength. They have $752 million in liquidity and no major debt maturities until 2027. So fairly strong fundamentals for Phillips Edison. I also covered a REIT that is in the kind of manufactured home and RV space. So this is Equity Lifestyle Properties. They are focused on, as their name implies, lifestyle-driven customer experience. They are mainly in the Sun Belt. They announced earnings on October 22nd. They missed on earnings and missed on revenue. They're seeing quite a bit of normalization across their portfolio after seeing kind of a huge boom post-pandemic. So during the third quarter, their FFO increased by 5.3%. RV revenue, annual revenue, is growing 6.9% year-to-date. They've planned to increase rents at an average of 5% for most of its manufactured home residents in 2025. And they've seen, they're expecting increases of 5.5% at their RV sites. And over 95% of annual sites that they have for RVs already have tenants confirmed. So they raised their FFO guidance by 1 cent per share to $2.92. And that is a 6% growth rate compared to 2023. They continue to capitalize on strong demand across the Sun Belt. They are focused on Florida, California, Arizona. Occupancy across the markets that they're focused on in those states ranges from 95 to 97%. They're expanding 1,500 manufactured home sites in Florida, reinforcing their commitment to the region. They have launched significant digital marketing efforts, including the 100 Days of Camping campaign. They said that there were about 40 million impressions online. One thing to note about Equity Lifestyle is that they have seen a really big post-COVID normalization. RV demand has softened. Seasonal rents are down quite a bit in that space. And Hurricanes Helene and Milton also caused significant damage to some of their properties. So they're seeing pretty high operational costs. They're really testing the company's resilience to some of these storms. Labor shortages are a big issue in the RV business, which is limiting some efficiencies for them. But despite a lot of these challenges, they do maintain their long-term strategy. They're expecting to maintain steady rate growth, expand their footprint, particularly in Florida. They want to leverage joint ventures, and they've been able to reinforce their financial position through some strategic refinancing. But they're seeing strong customer demand across the Sun Belt. Looks like they're headed for some strong growth in 2025. I also covered some specialty sectors. One is gaming and leisure properties. So as their name implies, they're focused on gaming or effectively casino properties. They lease them to operators. Some of their main tenants are Bally's and Penn Entertainment. They announced earnings on October 25th. They missed on earnings and more or less met expectations for revenue. In quarter three, they reported significant growth driven by some acquisitions of Tioga, Rockford, and Casino Queen Marquette, along with Bally's Chicago. So they've seen a boost in cash income. They had investment activity in the neighborhood of $2 billion this year. That's delivered them about 8.5% yield. They did reach a strategic milestone with their first 30-year bond issuance. Now, on the flip side, operating costs for them jumped by $22.6 million. This was driven by a lease reclassification of the Tropicana Casino. They're also dealing with a potential rent increase under an amendment on a lease with Penn, and that's adding a little financial pressure to them. But one interesting thing is that financing for new construction projects, particularly for tribal facilities, does remain tricky for them in the current credit environment. This is obviously a headwind. They're exploring some potential new tribal financing structures that will allow some of their tribal partners to convert loans into leases, which could open up a new revenue stream for them in the next year. But it seems from their call that the balance sheet remains fairly healthy, and they think that they'll be able to navigate some market challenges in 2025. Another specialty REIT I covered was Digital Realty Trust. So they are an owner of data centers, And some of their big tenants are everything from cloud service providers to other AI projects. And as demand for digital infrastructure continues to grow, Digital Realty is expanding globally. They're cementing their place as a key player in the data economy. They did miss on earnings, but they slightly beat on revenue. In the third quarter, they reported a leasing volume of $521 million. That was more than double their previous high. And large-scale leases accounted for a massive portion of those at $450 million. But they did have a backlog that jumped by 60% to $859 million. Most of these leases are expected to kick off in late 2025 or early 2026. So they had core FFO at $1.67 a share. That was fueled by revenue growth from data centers, which is up 11%. They had strong performance that allowed them to raise their guidance on core FFO to $6.65 to $6.75 per share. They also have a significant development pipeline. This grew nearly 50% to 644 megawatts. 74% of that is pre-leased. And they had $66 million in bookings for their interconnection services. So they've seen that business up across the board. They also made an acquisition in the UK, so strengthening their position in Europe. There are some challenges, though, that were covered on their call. Higher utility costs in Europe are a big concern. There have been a couple of customer bankruptcies that have added some pressure to their financials. Management also flagged some delays on deals in Q4, which I mentioned previously when discussing the backlog. But despite this, they seem convinced that they're positioned for a good 2025. They have really strong lease renewal spreads, built-in increases on most of their other leases. And generally, they're very bullish on AI adoption and just continued growth in that business. They have a global expansion strategy, a very large leasing pipeline. Seems like they're on track for a lot of long-term success. So overall, some big takeaways from these calls. I think there's some major dispersion in the results by sector. A lot of bright spots in growth sectors. I think you heard that in industrial and data centers. This is really driven still by e-commerce, general logistics providers, and of course, artificial intelligence. We see some lingering impacts of remote work in the office sector, but some good news from SL Green for some of that Class A space, especially here in New York. And you also heard on some of these calls that we are starting to see some hurdles for retail, some concerns about the health of the consumer. I think those were reflected in last quarter's calls as well. At the company level, Prologis and Rexford definitely see some steady demand. Digital Realty is benefiting from strong leasing as well, though I think you heard there that some utility costs and deal delays do loom for them. On the office side, SL Green is seeing a lot of good news, positive leasing momentum in New York. Highwoods is seeing some positive leasing momentum across the Sun Belt. And they're pretty hungry for transactions. They just have not seen anything yet that they want to pick up. Grocery-anchored retail is pretty resilient, but there are some consumer risks, as I mentioned. This, you know, is applicable to both ROIC and Phillips Edison. Turning to gaming and leisure properties and equity lifestyle, they're having some operational challenges, and each of them had a strong post-pandemic recovery, and they seem optimistic about future growth, even if they're not going to see that 2021-2022 huge growth. But across all sectors, rising costs, tight financing, these are going to shape the story going into 2025. Those were just eight calls that I ended up covering across a number of sectors. Like I said, this week upcoming, or by the time you will have heard this, there will be dozens more of public REITs that will have announced their earnings. And hopefully we can cover those on either another podcast or in some other format. But definitely something to keep an eye out on as we discuss the market heading into 2025. I did want to make a few announcements, and one is that the Q4 edition of our industry conditions and sentiment survey is now open for participation. So this is the survey that we've covered on the podcast a number of times. It intends to capture market sentiment, conditions, metrics, issues, you name it, impacting the U.S. commercial real estate industry and Canada for that matter. So if you are listening to the show, we definitely want your opinion. We will post a link to that in the show notes. We would love to see your participation. We've also got a number of upcoming data releases and more earnings calls. So while I can't call out all of them, I'll name a few key ones that I'll certainly be paying attention to. So as far as data releases are concerned, by the time this episode will be released on October 29th, we'll have gotten the job openings and labor turnover survey. On October 30th, we'll get GDP data and the ADP employment survey. October 31st, I will receive the employment cost index. November 1st, the October jobs report and construction spending data. And then November 4th, we'll receive manufacturers' shipment, inventory, and orders. And November 5th, you'll see international trade data, and it's also election day. As far as earnings calls are concerned, way more than I can mention on the call or on the podcast, but on October 29th, so by the time you will be listening to this episode, Tower, Brixmore Property Group, and Regency Centers. On the 30th, BXP, Park Hotels and Resorts, and Extra Space Storage. And on the 31st, Mid-America Apartment Communities, Equity Residential, Public Storage, and Kite Realty. So definitely keep an eye out on some of those. There's many more. I encourage you to look at a calendar of some of the REIT earnings calls if there are any you're interested in. But I think that is all the time we have today. Before we sign off, I want to share with you how you might be able to give some feedback on the show. If you want to leave a message or feedback via voice recording, we do have a function for that. Check the show notes and you'll find a link to do so. I'd also encourage you to rate or comment on the show the old-fashioned way or on your preferred podcast platform. Just comment back. Or the extra old-fashioned way, you can send us an email. We have altusresearch@altusgroup.com. We would love to know what topics you'd like covered on the program or if you want to give us some feedback on what you've already heard. In the meantime, really appreciate you all joining us for another episode of CRA Exchange, and we will be back in a few weeks. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the CRE Exchange podcast, powered by Altus Group. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a 5-star review and be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a global leader in asset and fund intelligence for commercial real estate. At Altus, we bring together capabilities across technology, analytics, valuations, tax, and development advisory services. We are guided by bold thinking, integrity, and inclusivity, partnering with CRE professionals to maximize opportunities with exceptional service experience. Find out more at altusgroup.com.